nearby that's a conductor. My wife is one of the many people that when she has a head scan and an MRI scanner, which is a slightly scanning strong magnetic field, she develops some after effects. You notice that whenever you put a human being into an MRI machine, you put them on this cart that slowly wheels the person into the machine. And usually the head is held in some kind of a structure, so the head doesn't move. And you think they're holding the head steady to make sure that the picture doesn't get blurred. Well, there's another effect going on. When your head is in the middle of that superconducting magnet at around 3 Tesla, which is a pretty strong magnetic field, if you shook your head back and forth rapidly, or nodded your head up and down rapidly, you would be inducing voltages into the saline conducting solution that's in your brain. By Faraday's law, you would be a moving conductor inside of a magnetic field. You'll be inducing voltages. You'll be doing yourself electroshock therapy. I'm only half kidding when I say this. If you move your head rapidly in any manner inside of that machine, you're going to get at least psychedelic effects, maybe electroshock therapy effects, maybe some other after effects. So a certain percentage of people who get a brain scan, an MRI, do have some after effects. And it might not be psychosomatic. It might be real for a whole lot of reasons.
Repeater, time out.
Magnets can do real magic. We talk about the field lines of a magnet. You put two bar magnets close together. If they're opposite in polarity, north and south, they attract. If they're same in polarity, north-north or south-south, they repel. By putting a piece of paper over that scene and dropping iron filings on it, you will trace out what we call the magnetic lines of force. But I've asked some pretty informed people, like Roy, for instance, AC2GS, magnetic lines of force. The words roll off the tongue real easily. What is that? What really is there in the air or vacuum between those two magnets that's doing that? And that's what the magic of that magnetic field, I think, is the major component of the transmission of a radio wave. That's my belief. And I have reason to believe there might not be an E-field there at all. When you put a conductor there, like an antenna, to sense that electromagnetic wave, you've now introduced that conductor by Faraday's law, and a voltage gets induced into your conductor of your antenna. The magnetic field induced the voltage. Was there really a voltage in free space that also got coupled into your antenna? I think the answer might be no. I'm in the minority. People think I'm crazy for believing that. That's a tough one. So what really is a radio wave? This all got started with me. Let me drop this. When in 1971 or 72, Apollo 15, I set up this 12-foot dish in Farmingdale, Long Island, at the back door of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, this 12-foot dish at 2.3 gigahertz, 2287.5 megahertz, aimed at the moon. The transmission from the moon is a 10-watt signal, a quarter of a million miles away, with nothing in between but hard vacuum between Earth and moon. Something went through that hard vacuum between moon and Earth, and a very small amount of signal of minus 120 dBm appeared at my antenna in Farmingdale, and I listened to astronaut audio. Something went through, energy went through that medium. We call it a radio wave. What really traversed? There was nothing but a hard vacuum between Earth and moon at the beginning of the transmission, during the transmission, at the end of the transmission. There's absolutely nothing there. And not a single electron left that antenna from the moon. And yet I'm hearing that signal. So that was the beginning of my mental search. What the heck is a radio wave? What really is it? We've got a bunch of ways of explaining it. I've got a bunch of ways of controlling it, explaining it, predicting it. I can predict within a small fraction of a dB of error. What is the signal strength of the Voyager signal, 13 billion miles away, 10-watt signal. Let me drop. 317 dB of free space loss. between Voyager and Earth. The thing is three times beyond the distance of Pluto. I have often amused myself by calculating how strong is that signal. I just plug it into a bunch of equations that we all know to some degree. And you know exactly how strong the signal is going to be at the Goldstone 240-foot dish in California. And I've been at that dish, by the way. And how strong that signal is going to be, minus 164 dBm. And what they've got to do to receive that signal, very weak signal, from a very long distance, 37 hours round trip at the speed of light for the signal to go out there and come back. And the signal has to go out there and come back because Voyager uses the uplink signal as its frequency reference and phase reference to send the signal back down. So there's a real referencing signal that John was asking us about. 13 billion miles away, the system locks up to the nearest 50 hertz of receiver bandwidth at 8.5 thousand megahertz. 8.5 gigahertz is the center frequency, roughly, and it's a 50 hertz bandwidth. If you consider the 8.5 gig NASA band to be 500 megahertz wide, 8.0 to 8.5, you could say that that's their band. And if they said, hey, I'm calling CQ to Voyager, carefully tuning the band, and you tune across that 500 megahertz, 8.0 to 8.5, and each one of your channels is 50 hertz wide, there's a million channels in there. You've got to select the right one for the Doppler shift and frequency and whatever today. If it was a crystal reference on board, you would have great difficulty finding that signal. Goldstone with a...
Repeater, timeout.
Goldstone with a 10 kilowatt transmitter into a 74 dB gain dish that gives them terawatts of ERP. We can calculate that. Tremendous amount of ERP. Sends the signal up to Voyager. It says to, hey, says to Voyager, here's my reference signal for you to talk back to me on. Hey, Voyager, how's it going out there? How strong are the solar particles out there that you're measuring? Flux field out there. How's it go? What's your battery voltage and whatever? So you start questioning Voyager by sending them an uplink signal at 10 gigahertz. It's a crystal mixer front-end receiver, not super sensitivity. They couldn't, there's a whole bunch of reasons why they couldn't put a low-noise amplifier in front of it. A crystal mixer front-end receiver takes 10 kilowatts of signal in the uplink to make sure you can hear it, that they can hear you, and it sends back a 10-watt signal, and you need state-of-the-art receiver down here to get that minuscule signal. And that dish on Voyager has to be aimed to the nearest tenth of a degree of accuracy. A dish has got to be aimed at the Earth. It's a 12-foot diameter dish, 43 dB of gain, I think it is, 44 dB of gain. Got to be aimed to the nearest tenth of a degree in azimuth and elevation directly at the Earth. Otherwise, you ain't going to hear that signal. 40 years downrange. There's enough positioning gas and whatever on board. Inertial wheels, I'm not quite sure how they're doing it. How in the world, 40 years later, can they aim to the nearest tenth of a degree at the Earth? From that, from 13 billion miles away, you aim at the Sun, that's close enough. There's a very small number of degrees of difference between the Sun and the Earth, so to speak. So if they got a solar detector and they just aim at the Sun, we would hear them. But still, you have to position that dish like...
Repeater, timeout.
You have to position that dish by some means, and they can't use magnetorquing out there. Ain't no magnetic field. You have to really do something inertially, squirting out a gas out of a reaction control jet, or winding up an inertial wheel of some kind, a great big gyroscope, a series of gyroscopes on board. How are they doing it? 40 years downrange, and it's still working. That's one heck of a success as I see it. That's why public broadcasting systems had a nice... Nova article on that exact subject. Okay, patiently waiting all this time is Howie, WB2HWW. What would you like to know about RCA connectors, Howie? You got it, Howie, K2RIW listening, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick.
22 minutes ago.
K2RIW, WB2HWW. All right. The question is this, just a historical question. RCA connectors have been around for a long time.
back in the 50s and 60s, they were used as RF connectors. The two coils, they were used by Motorola, even Collins. I think Heathkit used them on receivers and on some transmitters. The question is this. What is the impedance of that connector? Is that close to 15 ohms? And if they're put on right, that means if you take an RCA connector and put the shield over it, the old-fashioned metal-type RCA connectors, what I'm asking is, what's the impedance, and what do you think the insertion loss is, or how much power do you think those things can handle? I know that that some of that stuff is handled as much as 300 and 400 watts. You'll see them on interconnect cables, let's say in a Motrask or even a Micor. So I'm just wondering, and I think Collins used them on some of their equipment as RF connectors. So my question is, how good are they, and what do you think the upper frequency is for an RCA connector? I would assume that they'd be pretty good because they're not that big, and I would think they would be pretty close to 50 ohms. So back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if you're a little bit naive about transmission lines, and if your favorite transmission line is a 50-ohm coax, 70-ohm coax, you would think that, the connectors that I put on the end of that transmission line better be 50 ohms. That's a good beginning discussion, but it's much too restrictive. Stand by a minute. I'm wondering what that sound is now. I figured out what it is. Looks like that fan on my rig needs some lubrication. Because the RCA connector is in the vicinity of half an inch long, and if I was using it at the 450 ham band, where the wavelength there is around 27 inches, so that connector is a 27th of a wavelength long, it would give you beautiful performance. If its characteristic impedance is somewhere between 1 ohm and 1,000 ohms. If that connector had an impedance of 1 ohm, because I'm connecting it to an end of a 50 ohm line, but it's only a 27th of a wavelength long, and by way of a Smith chart or some formulas I could give you, I could tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get on the input end of that connector when your signal has to go through that connector and then go into your 50-ohm transmission line. When the length of the line is so short, the amount of perturbation it does is extremely small. Let me give you an example of what I really mean by that. A 50-ohm transmission line has something like 27 picofarad per foot of capacitance between the center conductor and the outer shield, and it's got some number of nanohenries of inductance along the length of that center conductor. As you change the diameter of the center conductor, leaving the outer conductor the same, you know that the bigger the center conductor is, the lower the impedance, and vice versa. What's really happening when you make the center conductor larger in diameter and leave everything else constant, you're going to get more capacitance per foot. And by a formula of square root of C over H, E over H, but by way of a formula, once you know the capacitance per foot and the inductance per foot, you know the impedance of the cable. Okay. Let's assume now that I should be using 50-ohm cable. It should be 50 picofarad, 27 picofarad per foot, if that's the number. That's it. It's a 50-ohm. And if it's now, let me pick a number, a 30-ohm connector, instead of 27 picofarad per foot, it's got 35 picofarad per foot. The capacitance per foot is going to increase. I don't know the exact number. We can calculate it. So I should have 27 picofarad per foot. In my example, I've got 35 picofarad per foot. I've got 8 picofarad too much. But I've only done it for a 27th of a wavelength. So the total number of picofarads, I don't have anywhere near a foot of connector there. I've only got half an inch of connector. I've added 0.01 picofarads of extra capacitance because it's a low impedance connector, but a half inch long. That gives you another feeling for how it's an extremely strong perturbation. If you calculated with a Smith chart, what would a 30...
Repeater, timeout.
I did this exact calculation for a connector that's 1.78 inches long 2 months ago in the article in QST magazine. The doctor is in. He talked about making a splice out of UHF connectors on 50 ohm cables. So you've got a UHF PL259, a pair of them, and a UHF 258, I think it is. You got a female-to-female adapter and a pair of PL259s. When you put that all together, the internal length of that combination is 1.78 inches long. And when you do the calculation correctly, and there was an error in that article, you do come up with 30 ohm impedance. When UHF connectors are properly mated, the internal impedance of that connector is very close to 30 ohms. So you're putting a 30 ohm connector, 1.78 inches long, on a 50-ohm cable. And you assume that all hell was going to break loose if you did that at 1250. Let me drop. Instead of that input connector presenting 50 ohms, it presents something like 43 ohms and a certain number of picofarads of capacitance. Something like a 1.2. It's a very small amount of standing wave ratio induced by that connector. For most situations, except for something very critical like moon bounce, it wouldn't matter one iota. And the nice thing about a UHF connector is it's got a great big hunking set of conductor pins. You could easily put 5 kilowatts key down through a UHF connector, as long as you've chosen a good brand, maybe the ones that are silver plated. You could put 5 kilowatts through that key down forever, as long as it's in open air to cool itself off a little bit. It can take a lot of power. It's got very little insertion loss, very little Vizwar impact. Even when you put 3 of them together to make the splice, a pair of PL259s, male, and a female to female bullet in the middle. And so the doctor is in to discuss that, and he had some very pessimistic answers about it. The way he worded the article, you wouldn't want to use it at 450. You could absolutely use it at 450, at 5 kilowatts. As long as you've got your special temporary authority license from the FCC so you can run moon bounce at 5 kilowatts. And a number of guys have done that. Let me drop it. You try to put... your favorite connector that gives you a perfect 50-ohm match is a Type N connector. And N stands for, by the way, the name Neil. Mr. Neil and Mr. Councilman invented that connector at Bell Labs way back in 1938 or something like that. So a Type N connector is a very good impedance match at 50 ohms. So you have strong motivation to use a type N connector. You put 1,000 watts to a type N connector at 450, and you're not going to survive. For Morse code, brief transmissions and sideband, yes. But you do key down, high duty factor transmission with a type N connector. The center conductor on that connector is so small in diameter, the current density of a kilowatt is so high, the center conductor gets so hot, you'll burn it up. It is not reliable at a kilowatt at 450, a type N connector, even though it's a perfect 50-ohm connector. And so if you use PL259s instead, you're way ahead of the game if you're smart enough to know what's really going on. So in the case of that RCA connector, its impedance doesn't matter. Is the center conductor large enough in diameter to take the amount of power you want to take? That center conductor on an RCA connector is a lot bigger than the center pin of a type N connector. It can take more power. If you actually try to measure the inner diameter, the outer diameter, the dielectric impedance in between, the dielectric constant of the insulator in between, let me drop it. You can come up with what you think is the characteristic impedance. And it might be 27.5 ohms. Doesn't matter. It is so small. Now, if you want to use that connector at X-band, where the wavelength is 1 inch and the connector is 1/2 inch long, that might give you some grief. But even then, you could learn to live with it. There's all kinds of ways you could correct the perturbation of the connector. Since most of what you do at X-band is going to be a piece of waveguide, and using that as a launching connector for your waveguide to coax adapter, and you put a screw in the right position in your waveguide, that gives you an impedance corrector. You simply put a screw in the right place in a waveguide, and you're building a poor man's double stump tuner. So even if that connector gave you a whole lot of perturbation at X-band, I could make it work like a charm in your transmitter and your receiver, Howie, by putting a screw in the waveguide at just the right spot and turning the screw in just the right number of turns and adjusting it on my vector network analyzer, my antenna analyzer, my standing wave ratio bridge, whatever. So the impedance of the RCA connector, to ask that question, very logical question to ask, but as you dig deep enough into the situation, it is a improper question. Let me drop. A type N connector, by the way, as long as the transmission is brief. A buddy of mine, Hank Keane, very smart RF engineer, now a silent key, W2CTK, used to live in Comac. He personally put at 1,000 megahertz, 1,200 megs, pulses of 20 kilowatts to a type N connector with a polonium nuclear source nearby to see if it would arc over. And it didn't. Brief pulses, the center conductor has got enough spacing to the outer conductor in a type N connector. Brief pulses, it'll take 20 kilowatts. But key down, CW, you put 1,000 watts through it, you're going to kill it. By the same token, the spacing between center conductor and outer conductor in an RCA phono plug, RCA connector, I'll bet you it'll also take 20 kilowatts, maybe even more, maybe 30. So now the only other failure mechanism is current density of the center conductor. So if you choose the right brand where you've got good finger closure on the female equivalent that you're going into, I mean, Motorola was using RCA connectors on the back end of their taxicab rigs for a whole lot of years. And we all looked at that and said, boy, that is a cheap idea. They were cutting corners. They were doing terrible things. And so some guys thought they were smart, in some cases, to drill a bigger hole and replace the connectors with type N male and female on that rig. They were wasting their time. I'm expressing a whole lot of opinions, and I'm giving you information as to where the opinions are coming from. Let me drop it. If you've been around RF for a whole lot of years, Howie, an awful lot of the old wives' tales about connectors in particular, the insertion loss of a connector. If I made the connector out of carbon granules, and it's only a half inch long, and I wanted to have 20 dB of loss, I couldn't do it. It doesn't have enough length. When it comes to transmission lines, you only get loss with reasonable construction techniques. I'm exaggerating when I said carbon granules. With reasonable construction techniques, you only get loss in a transmission line when it has length. We talk about the dB per 100 feet. That's the loss rating of the transmission lines you and I buy. dB per 100 feet. And now you want to convert that to dB per half inch? How many half inches are there in 100 feet? Thousands. A good transmission line has got a couple of dB of loss per 100 feet at UHF frequencies. The only way you couldn't measure that lower loss, if you and I put it on good laboratory equipment without doing some very fancy techniques, you couldn't measure the insertion loss of that RCA connector. The only way you could come close is to put 100 watts through it for 10 solid minutes and measure the temperature rise. That would allow you to calculate the loss by calorimetry techniques. But by normal techniques in real dBs, I'll bet you'd have trouble confirming that it has 0.01 or 0.02 dB, and that's close to what it really is, Howie. So measuring its insertion loss, so to speak, let me drop it. Or measuring its characteristic impedance, two very logical sounding questions with normal training that we go through to become ham radio operators. Those are very logical questions. But if you've got the next level of understanding of small length connectors, of reasonable construction techniques out of conducting and insulating materials, it's an improper question to ask its impedance. It's an improper question to ask its insertion loss. Take that. Sorry about that, Howie. WP2HWW. You're allowed to rebut this. Keep your RIW in the tech net.
Okay, no, I'm not going to rebut it. I agree with that 100%. That I agree with. why I was asking the question was just a curiosity, because, you know, they've been around for a long time, and I thought they would be closer to 50 ohms. Also, they seem to be low loss. Now, if you put, you know, let's put it to you this way. A lot of people, I think, don't realize what's the difference between loss and shielding. You have a piece of cable, it's 1 dB per 100 foot. You can have, you know, you can have good shielding and have some loss in the coax. They're independent. But the next, what I was just asking the questions of curiosity because of the fact that, you see, like, some of your repeater equipment, some of the old timers, when they would put an RCA connector on, let's say, the RG142. Now, the only reason why I don't think you would use an RCA connector if you're trying to put a piece of RG8U onto, you really can't. You can put maybe RG58U or smaller cables onto it, or you need some kind of an adapter. But if you're trying to do an interconnect inside of a receiver cabinet or whatever it may be, you could take the shield and put the shield all around the outside of the RCA connector and put the hot inside. If you do it right, you'll have a really very well shielded connection, Dick. And I'm going to have to go because something just came over to me. I don't know if you can hear it through the microphone. I got a four-legged friend that wants to go out. So I'll listen out for your comments. But I understand that it's a very small percentage of the wavelength. I was just asking an historical question, Dick. That's all. K2RIW. WB2H, W&OU, but I can remember a lot of the older equipment using RCA connectors.
Don't worry, Howie. You asked an extremely good question. Very logical. And now what you just tacked on, now you've hit pay dirt. In the case of a UHF, a type N connector, you've got an internal mechanism. You've got a beautiful 5H24 threaded mechanism on the outside on the nut male and female interface. And in the case of the precision type N connector, you have a very precision mating of the outer conductor of the male end and the outer conductor of the female end. The way that mates, if you properly installed a type N connector on the end of your double shielded RG214 cable, for instance, you can get more than 100 decibels of shielding out of that connector, properly mated, torqued down, properly installed on the end of the cable. Approximately 100 dB of shielding. Now, that's the one place where a RCA connector cannot hack it. You've got these four little flanges on the outside that don't make contact around the full 360 degrees. If you and I used jumper cables on a repeater duplexing filter, and if those jumper cables between the cavities were made with RCA connectors, I'm going to make a guess. My experience on shielding characteristics of connectors makes me make a guess that the amount of shielding of a RCA connector is in the vicinity of 60 or 70 dB. Not a hell of a lot more than that, maybe 80. And if you've got a very well-tuned duplexing filter, you can get 115 dB of
repeater timeout.
A well-tuned duplexing filter can give you 115 dB of isolation. But if you made those jumpers between the cavities out of RCA connectors, it would all go down the tubes. So when it comes to shielding, and when it comes to weatherproofing outdoors, and those two areas, that connector doesn't hack it. And if you were installing those outdoors and you tried to weatherproof it, it would be difficult. And if you need very state-of-the-art shielding, and if you need complete control of passive intermodulation distortion on your state-of-the-art cell site, that connector doesn't hack it. Compared to a 716th DIN connector, not even close. So for shielding and PIM, that connector doesn't have it. But on true insertion loss and true impedance match, it does a beautiful job, even though it's not designed for that, so to speak, and power handling. So it's got its strengths and its weaknesses. It gives you a hell of a lot of bang for the dollar. So when it comes to internal connections in an IF strip or the output connector of a taxi cab rig, It does the job beautifully. The only other thing I would fault with it is it doesn't have a threaded output. So therefore, if it's in a high vibration environment, like in the trunk of a taxi cab, let me drop it. I see the possibility of that connector shaking itself loose because it doesn't have a threaded holding structure. So when it comes to reliability in a high vibration environment, it's got a fault. When it comes to weatherproofing, it's got a fault. When it comes to state-of-the-art shielding of what your transmission line is capable of, it's got a fault. Nobody considers those three factors. Whenever they consider that connector, because of the training we've been given, we worry about its impedance and its insertion loss. So the two things that don't matter are the things that we worry about, and the three things that do matter, we don't worry about it until we discuss it a little bit more. Maybe with any further comments about all these strong opinions of mine, give me a call letters right now. K2IWNSNN. Hey, 2J. Go right ahead, Eric. And I bet you've used a lot of RCA connectors in your time. You've seen them on a lot of the rigs you worked on in the old days. But you'd be afraid to use one today for fear that people would laugh at you. But in certain applications, it gives you the biggest bang for the dollar. KE2EJ. K2IW, that'd be great, Eric.
K2IW, K2EJ. Well, the RCA connector's been around for a long time. We use it as a 75-ohm device. General Electric and Motorola use it as a 50-ohm device. Actually, most of the Master 1, Master 2 repeaters are the inputs to the receivers on RCA connector. And if you do a Google search, you'll find a number of people calculations based on the physical dimensions of the connector. And a few of the folks came up saying that the impedance of the device as it stands alone is about 55 ohms. They do say that it's short and it only becomes an issue when you get up to really high display of the data. And I don't know if you noticed this thing, but the radio has this noises that come and go. K2RWK, John.
Okay. Is the noise in there right now, Eric? Go ahead.
Of course, as soon as I mention it, it's pretty clean now.
Okay. And you're fairly sure you've heard the noises on my transmission, not on anybody else's transmission?
I actually tuned to...
sounds my rig was putting out. Was it shaking sounds like a fan that's rubbing, for instance?
It may well be. It could be coming in through the microphone. It could be a fan. Could be a little relaxation oscillator going on somewhere. It was that kind of noise, that intensity, its amplitude. At one point was very loud, and now it's not there at all.
Okay, I'll thank you for the report, Eric. I'll keep a listen for it. As you can tell, I'm wearing earphones, and I hear what's coming back out of the machine. And so, if, for instance, I made the mistake of turning off my speech processor, which I just did, I'd know that sound right away, for instance. Now, Eric, yes, Eric, you're one of the guys I want to talk to, and also I want to talk to Bill, QGZ, WB2QGZ on this one. Starting at 5 o'clock in the morning on ABC television, as they advertised, they're going to give you beautiful radar reports and personality reports. In other words, a real reporter standing in front of a camera in front of a scene because of Hurricane Irma. So starting at 5 o'clock in the morning, all day long, periodically CBS, periodically NBC, but continuously ABC television was covering that hurricane, and still covering it, I'm sure. And here's my question, Eric. ABC television had made maybe as many as 20 human beings scattered around various places in the state of Florida. Some of them near Key West, some of them near Homestead, some of them near Boca Raton. Trying to think of names of all of the towns, zillion towns, and all these guys are sending back beautiful audio, most of the time good, beautiful video, most of the time good audio, and because right now millions of human beings in Florida are without electrical power, so with all kinds of failure of the power, with all kinds of failures of sometimes phone systems, by some means these guys are transmitting signals back to, I'm going to say, headquarters of ABC in New York, where I think it's being broadcast from, but I'm not sure about that. But they're transmitting it to some place remote from Florida. If you try to do that by satellite with a KU band dish, in all of that high wind, I think you'd have great trouble aiming that dish. So I don't think they're doing it by satellite. What do you believe is the method by which the signal is getting from the electronic news gathering site, which sometimes is a trailer, but no, they weren't using trailers. These are ENG sites, portable ENG sites that were shipped into these sites in a suitcase. By some means, 20 guys are transmitting signals back to some place remote from Florida. How the hell are they doing that? One guess I had is that LNA...
Repeater, timeout.
The recent cell site modification, LNG, ENG, you know what I'm talking about, the 700 meg type stuff, where they got relatively broad data bandwidth. By way of a cell site-like system, if you can get that signal to a cell site, which gets it into a fiber cable, and apparently the fiber cables in the ground from Florida have extremely high reliability to get that signal out of there. That's my guess as to how they're doing it. But you being in the broadcast industry probably know a hell of a lot more about it. Tell us all of the above. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
AT&T.
K2LIW, K2EJ. You're a little overthinking this. There's two probable ways in which you're seeing the images and audio. First of all, let me tell you that the typical ENG might be running, if they're running MPEG-4, the bit rate will only be around 1.5 to 2 megabits. If they're running MPEG-2, it'll probably be around 3 or 4. That's one thing. Now, if you happen to be, like I know, a couple of the stations where they were transmitting had, a TV station nearby, and there is the 2 gigahertz link, which is kind of works in the rain, depends on how far away you are. But ultimately, the real way this works, let me let it drop because there's a little bit of an explanation here. Ultimately, the way things are working, like you might see somebody driving in a car and they're driving down the road and yet you get a nice picture and sound from them. And basically what they have are these rigs, it's called distributed processing. They'll actually take that 1.4 megabits and break it up into about 12 or 14 pieces. And each one may run about 9,600 baud or less. And these docks that they use with the camera has basically cell phone modems in them. And as you know, each cell phone company maintains their own towers, their own power, and their way of getting into the network. What we essentially do is we may have 6 or 8 or 10 of these different little modem cards, which are in some cases actually cell phones themselves, is mounted in this dock that has all of those little cards plugged into it. And two of the cards may be on Verizon, another one might be on AT&T, another one might be Wi-Fi, hotspot, various different ways and methods. And what we do is we split that video stream apart and send it down each one of these guys with some FEC, and then at the receiving end, we gather up all of these different signals and put them back together, and that's ultimately how you're seeing most of this stuff. K2RW, K2J.
WS2N.
they gave an answer like that.
Okay. Somebody tried to break in before Eric picked up. Paul recognized. We're going to pick you up in a second. It sounded like TNT, TXT. That's all we heard. Who was that person? Please give us slowly your full call letters and your name, sir. K2RIW. Okay, Paul. I think you're saying they told us how they did it. Who's a they and when did they tell us how they did it? WS2N, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Yeah, I saw that. I believe it was on CNN. I keep switching back and forth, but I'm pretty sure it was CNN. And the one guy asked the guy in the field, how are you getting these signals? How are you transmitting? So he went through a story very similar to what Eric just said. He said they're splitting it up into half a dozen or more signals, all the different wireless cell phone companies. As long as some of the towers, they all don't have to be working. But, you know, if at least a couple of them are working, we're going to get the signal through. And he said the cell phone towers, of course, all have battery backups. He said that most of them have, he said, 16-hour battery backups for the cell phone towers. So that's really what he said. And that's, I mean, not as technical as Eric, but basically that's what he said. Half a dozen or more different components are going out at the same time with different companies. Back.
I think they're also using a time domain, frequency domain, digital techniques for the actual transmission method. And that's part of what I think Eric was telling us. That gets it to the cell site. Cell sites are probably equally as vulnerable to the power dropout. Millions of people in Florida right now do not have rural electrical power. And so the battery backup at the cell sites are good for some number of hours. I'm hoping that some of those cell sites also have a diesel generator backup to carry them for a longer period of time than the 8 hours of battery. Because I'd like to be seeing these pictures from Florida beyond the 8 hours that a cell site can stay on the air without rural power. What's your guess on that one, Eric? In the case of the...
Listen to your audio.
Okay. I'm listening to my audio, and I hear a little bit of squiggling in the background. I think I hit it with my radio mallet. The radio mallet is connected to the wrist on my right hand. Yes, my rib needs some work. I hope more of the Florida stations have generator backup, but because of the cost, I imagine they do not. In a couple of key places in the metropolitan area of New York City, some of the key cell sites do have generator backup, but I bet very few of them down there do. As such, if the batteries are only good for 8 hours, that would suggest that beyond 8 hours, and real power dropout started happening at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon today. So 8 hours from 5 in the afternoon, does that mean we're not going to see any more television pictures, Eric? Is that what you think might happen? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
That guy said 16 hours. The guy said 16 hours on CNN.
Oh,
repeater, timeout.
Okay, but are we going to lose it after 16 hours? Over to you, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I have a place down in Florida, so I'm actually quite familiar with what they do, and as you go down the highway that heads to the Keys, you'll see that there's towers that are spaced, and all of them, not only are they battery backed up, but they have generators. Along the highways, pretty much most of those facilities have their own generator system. It's more sporadic like this. Cell site that I'm sitting under is powered by my big generator that runs. But they have individual. If you remember when we had Sandy, I remember Mr. Shuck talking about, getting portable generators to a lot of different sites. So there are a lot of sites that are just on battery power. And when they have to operate them for extended periods of time, they got to roll from generators and. Wait a minute, drop. The thing that's because you're such an analog guy. In terms of what we do with the video signal that comes from the EMG truck, it's a single stream, right? And what we can do is we can take individual packets from the stream. We can then actually add what you call a four-quadrant FCC. Essentially, you can lose two of six streams and still reconstruct the signal. So essentially, we don't do any fancy thing other than the normal spectrum that's, you know, a CDMA of the cell tower. Actually, we don't do anything RF-wise. We just send IP data to the various different modems, making the connection to wherever the receive station is that has the computer that puts it all back together. So it's really a lot simpler than what you were trying to make out there. K2RIW, can you do it, John?
K2IS, query.
Bill recognized. Get you in there, Bill. You just said a mouthful. For whatever reason, as you drive the major highways in Florida, you see cell sites with generator backup on a high percentage of them. Very significant. That makes it possible, as I see it, to go way beyond the 16 hours of battery backup. And if they're really transmitting from the moving vehicles, from the stationary ENG sites and whatever, by way of the nearest cell site, and the cell site is that reliable, and once that signal on the cell site is put into a piece of fiber.
We use multiple cell sites. We don't use a single cell site, otherwise if the cell site goes down, it's gone.
Okay, when you say multiple cell sites, does that mean they flip back and forth between the cell sites, or during one particular ENG transmission, are multiple sites, cell sites being used truly simultaneously? Give me some words on that one, Eric.
Alright, as you may know in your travels, like for example, on my tower I have a cell site, but it only services T-Mobile. Down the block is another cell site. It only services Verizon. Around the corner there's another cell site, and it serves Sprint. So, as you get the idea, depending upon the cell company, where they could buy land use rights and stuff like that, they plop their tower. Sometimes they make these agreements where there's multiple companies on a single tower, and in many cases they're not. They're independent sites all over the place. Right? So now, I have this dock which has a bunch of slots in it, which I can put, it would look like little PCM MCIA cards that you used to use in your computer. Let me let it drop again. And each one of these cards is a modem. It's a cell modem. Actually, your cell phone is a modem because your cell phone doesn't transmit analog anything. It transmits IP data. And these cards are basically a cell phone without a microphone and a speaker. They have an Ethernet connection that hooks up to this other device. And so now in this dock, I have a cell phone modem for Verizon, which might be Tower A over there. And I have another modem for Sprint, which might be Tower C in a different direction. I have another modem that's for Verizon, which might be on another tower 4 miles away instead of 2 miles away. And because I have all of this connectivity, if I lose one or two of them, I can still get my sound and pictures back because I'm going to take these little bits of data that are being sent by these modems to the different cell companies, and they're all essentially dialing into a series of phone numbers that connect you to a specific computer that takes whatever packets it gets, and with the error correction that's involved, they're actually able to provide the missing data that might not be coming from cell site number C. Get the idea? K2IW, K2J.
Yes, I do, Eric. Does that mean that at the broadcast center, to make sure they've got high reliability, they might be listening to the simultaneous transmissions of this particular ENG site that comes to them by way of Sprint, Nextel, Verizon, T-Mobile? Are they spending enough money to listen to the multiple brands at the broadcast center simultaneously into that computer to make sure there's no interruption if one of them drops out? Do they go to that extra expense, or is that usually not required? KE2EJ, KE2LIW in the TechNet.
KE2IS for the comment.
Alright, well, let me tell you that the way a lot of these work, for example, I use a number of these devices on various different applications. And by the way, the system, when you get into places where it's really congested, sometimes they even have trouble making a connection. The connection is actually a telephone number, okay, and each one of these devices is dialing a different telephone number. And however it gets into the public switch network, by whatever method, they're going to wind up calling a phone number in essence. Now, the manufacturers of these devices, actually, like the ones that I use, is a company called Teradek, and they actually have set up in an ISP somewhere in the middle of the world the receiving part of their equipment. Now, let me let it drop. They, for a usage fee, will take the data from the dock and reconstruct it for you and send that via fiber as another IP signal back to TV stations. There are some of the big networks that maintain their own equipment in their own centers, but essentially it means that they need to be an ISP, so to speak, to have the ability to get connection from everywhere. And for some networks, that's fine and dandy, and it's not really an additional expense to them. And for the smaller guys, you use the service of the manufacturer, and it's not really expensive. So, you know, it's worth your while. K2RW, K2EJ, and then pick up your comment. Yeah, I'm about to go to Bill right now. We amateurs pride ourselves in being communicators. And I'm amazed that we as communicators, that more of us don't ask the question, how in the world is that signal from that extremely difficult environment being attacked by Mother Nature in the worst possible way? How in the world are all of those 20 electronic news gathering portable sites in mobiles and whatever, all sending that signal back? That communication channel reliability is amazing to me. On a couple of occasions, I could tell that George Stephanopoulos, who was on for a large number of hours today on ABC, he's a very smart guy, a very good broadcaster, but he's not a radio man. There were times when the radio itself was giving him some funny squeaking sounds in the background, and he thought that that was the sound of the wind. On another occasion, the personality in front of the camera, let me drop. The personality in front of the camera was using a wireless mic, and they were getting an RF dropout on the wireless mic. And George Stephanopoulos talked to the personality and said, hey, we're not hearing your audio. Please get closer to the microphone. So he didn't understand what was quite going on. And I understand that. I mean, let me say one more thing, Dick.
Okay, let me pick up Bill. He's waited long enough. AC2IS, go ahead and give us your comment and question, Bill. Then we'll go over to Eric. AC2IS, K2RW, you got it, Bill.
This is AC2IS. So my question was, I mean, all these remote news bands, they used to have satellite links. So why is it that in a situation like this that they would not think of going to satellite links first? It seems to me that that might be more reliable. So that was the question. And then the comment is, you know, what's been described in terms of using multiple cell sites sounds to me like sort of a common technology that's sometimes referred to as link bonding or WAN bonding or sometimes broadband bonding. When you do it with cell modems, there's one company called Cradlepoint who's had products out there for a long time that at least will work with a single cell modem, but there are other companies like Mushroom Networks, et cetera, that have been doing this for a long time. And for, you know, not a whole lot of dollars compared to, I think, what the news industry tends to spend on things. There was some particular vendor mentioned. I missed that, and I'd like to hear a repeat of what the vendor was that sort of reassembled this traffic in the cloud on the internet. Most of the solutions I'm aware of require you to buy a gateway device. And also, when you're using them, a gateway device for each end of the connection. When you're using these things, the cell companies don't really need to be aware of this at all. So it's not really, the innovation is not really specific to the cell technology involved, but more to the IP connectivity, bonding multiple internet connections together via the WAN gateways on each end of the connection. That's it, AC2IS.
I'm amazed you didn't time out on that one, Bill. You came very close. You think the satellite's going to be more reliable? In the case of the KU band uplink, where you want to steer the dish to the nearest 1 degree at that satellite in a 140-mile-an-hour wind if you're out in the open air, do you think that's more reliable? Second of all, if your electronic news gathering portable group are on the fourth floor of a building, you happen to be on the south-facing apartment in that building, you're on the fourth floor of a nine-floor building, and you got to aim your dish to the southwest, you have to aim the dish through four more floors of building to get to that satellite. You think satellite is more reliable? I don't. Whereas these cell sites are now so well established all over the place. As long as they've got the bandwidth, as long as you've got coverage to that cell site, and there's enough of them, you've got the coverage. And if they got the reliability with backup batteries and backup generators, I can see how that's a hell of a lot better. Eric, please answer all of the above. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
All right, K2RIW, KE2EJ. I apologize for not giving you the name of the system. It's called Bonded Cellular, which is exactly what Bill was talking about. And that's the methodology. As far as the cell companies are concerned, they know nothing. They're just providing a connection from point A to point B. It's just like your cell phone would. The same thing. The same formats. The same everything. So for them, it's just another phone call. Actually, and think about the kind of weather and rain and stuff and the way transmitting KU through that and the scattering of the polarization is trying to get it up to the satellite beyond just the wiggle of trying to keep the dish in one place. Actually, we do have a solution to that, and there are dishes that have their own radome that mount on flat surfaces that are completely servo-controlled, where the guy just pushes a button on the truck and finds your satellite, points it at it, and he can drive, and it stays pointing at it. They have those types of self-sensing antennas on boats and things of that nature. So that is not so much a big issue as the weather itself being a problem. As far as doing a remote from a hotel, let me write it to app again. Any production organization that knows that they're going to do something in such and such a location can do it with a flyaway pack, which comes as a bunch of ammo cases, including the dish, and you can set that up on a flat surface, and they don't have to be terribly big. You're just paying for it with power. Any decent production organization will have scouted their locations, know where they're going to put stuff long before they ever get there. So the bonded cellular in a case like the hurricane, where you don't know where you're going to be, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get it to work. And if you happen to be in a metropolitan area, like if you were at Fort Myers or you were at Tampa, we have all these local ENG links, which are basically 2 gigs. And they work pretty well in pretty extreme weather, too. Depends upon how far away you are. And, for example, at my location, I have a remote ENG receiver for NBC. So a major metropolitan area will have remote ENG pickup sites where the antennas are steerable and all operated from the studio. And whether you realize it or not, if you happen to be in Hawaii and you're watching television, you don't realize it, but the signal comes from Syracuse, New York. If you're watching TV from Channel 21, you're watching signals that are coming from Syracuse, New York. if you're watching NBC, you don't realize it. The studio may be at 30 Roth, but it goes down to Atlanta first and then comes back up to New York to be transmitted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That was due to workforce reduction by making what they call joint master controls. Let me let it drop again.
Yeah, how does ABC signal get...